This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We want to hear from you now about TV. Is there an old television show you've just started watching lately, or is there a show that you have rewatched once or a whole bunch of times? Call in now and tell us about it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Well, what brings this up now? Well, you know, between TV and all the streaming channels and apps out there, seems like we've never had more new shows to pick from or a bigger back catalog of older shows we can watch. That means some shows are getting a second life on streaming. You may have seen in the news this drama series, Suits, aired its last episode in 2019. I didn't notice it at the time, but lately, according to Netflix, you know, they're not real forthcoming with their numbers, but according to Netflix, that show, Suits, has become one of the most popular shows on Netflix. Anecdotally, I know many people who are obsessed with that show now. So again, we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What shows are you always able to go back and rewatch? Do you have a comfort show you go back to from time to time? What makes it hold up? Have you gone to an older show and found that it didn't hold up? Or have you found something that was on back then, you didn't see it then, but you love it now? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Going to give a little listen to this show, Suits. Now, our producers, they're watching a lot of these old shows. Rochelle says, I watched Suits when it originally aired on USA Network in the early 2010s. So she was ahead of the curve here. And a part of the rewatch craze right now, USA was getting to be known around that time for a solid lineup of original drama/comedies, and action shows like Royal Pains and Burn Notice. Okay, so here's a clip that Rochelle picked for us from Suits. Hotshot lawyer Harvey Specter comes to the apartment of his protege, Mike Ross, who's a fake lawyer practicing law without a degree.
It's a nice building. How long ago was it condemned?
Oh, great. So did you come all the way over here just to criticize where I live, or is...
That's a side benefit. Get your tux on. We got a situation.
A situation that requires a tux. Where is this tuxedo situation?
Atlantic City. Can you get dressed now?
Yeah, I could.
But?
I don't have a tux. I'm not Bruce Wayne.
Don't I know it?
Clip from Suits. Now let's go to your calls and Facebook comments. Call in at 800-642-1234 with your rewatchable TV shows. Owen starts us off in Milwaukee. Owen, hi.
Hello, hi.
What's your show, Owen?
Doctor Who. Big Doctor Who fan.
Okay. Now, I got to ask, which Doctor Who? Because you got about, 60, 70 years of back catalog you could work through there?
Hey, I love them all. I've seen pretty much most of the episodes at this point, especially the newer series that started in 2005.
Who was your entry point doctor? Because this is, for people who don't know Doctor Who, it's been around forever. It's a science fiction show, and there's a conceit in the show where a different actor can play the main character over the years. Who did you come in on, Owen?
I started with the new series. I thought like going to the back to the old series would be a little bit too daunting. Because I wasn't used to it yet. So I started a new series, started with Nine, played by Christopher Eccleston. And I got hooked on it.
All right, Owen. And you rewatch some episodes too? Or do you just keep digging and digging through that catalog?
I tend to rank episodes, and those like top 10 episodes I've seen at least like 5 times each, if not more.
Oh, and I should ask, how are you watching it? Does a streaming service have everything, or are you having to track down DVDs, or how are you watching Doctor Who?
I used to do it at a library where I'd pick up like some of the DVDs, but yeah, and mainly HBO Max, I believe, has the whole catalog at this point. I know Doctor Who might be on Disney Plus soon, but HBO Max currently has all the new series.
All right. Well, you're set for life on that one. There's a lot to watch. Owen, thanks a lot for calling in at 800-642-1234, asking you to share the shows that you rewatch maybe once, maybe again and again, or an older show that you didn't watch when it was around. Maybe it was before you were born even, that you have watched and enjoyed or not. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. A bunch of people have done that. Gabe writes, The Sopranos, still the GOAT. That's youth slang, greatest of all time. Now, that's an interesting one. Because I think of a show like The Wire, right? That's like prestige TV, if you said, Rob, you got to pick one best show of all time, I might say The Wire. Would I go back and watch it again? I don't know. It's kind of painful to watch sometimes. Like, a lot of bad stuff happens to sympathetic characters along the way. So that's interesting. I don't know. The prestige TV, I don't know if it always is something you want to rewatch. Correct me if I'm wrong. 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. B is with us in Prairie du Chien. B, hello.
Hi. Mad Men. Loved it.
Mad Men?
Didn't watch it when it first came out, but we loved it off of Netflix.
Okay. So you didn't watch it the first time through. What is it that made you say, okay, I should go check the show? Was it just hearing from your friends about it?
Yeah, everybody kept talking about it and how great it was, and I missed out on something good, and I think they were correct.
Now, this is one of those shows, there's a lot like this, where my wife and I start watching, I kind of fizzle out, she keeps watching and watching, she really loved it. What about it would you say to encourage me to pick it up again, B?
I liked it because of all of the side stories that went into the program, and you almost actually felt like when the last episode aired, you still wonder about the people, you know, all the characters, and wondering what they're still doing in the show. You know, it's kind of one of those thought processes.
Interesting, B. Thanks a lot for calling in at 800-642-1234. We'll go to Anne now in Waldo. Anne, what's your show?
Twilight Zone.
Now, the original, there have been a couple reboots of the Twilight Zone over the years. Are you talking original Rod Serling Twilight Zone?
Well, I'm talking the original, but I just started watching the newer stuff, and it's pretty good.
All right. There are three words, Anne, that give me chills if I think about it while I'm driving the car. Those three words are going my way. You know what I'm talking about?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. That's a scary one.
I don't even want to think about it right now.
Yeah, my favorite one is the one where the aliens attack the old woman's house and she beats them with a broom. And then when they leave, you see it's a spaceship from the United States of America. So she's killed all these astronauts from the United States. It's a great one. But yeah, it's a great show. It's got great twists, very well written. Even though it's, you know, years ago, it really is just ageless. It's great.
Excellent, Ann. Thanks a lot for that recommendation. Spoiler alert on that last one, though. We are taking your calls with your favorite TV shows to either rewatch or maybe a show that you missed when it was around. Maybe it was before your time, and you discovered it and loved it or hated it. You can join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Monique is with us now in Plainfield. What's your show, Monique?
Hi, Gunsmoke.
Okay, now I got it.
The reason that Gunsmoke ran for 20 years.
It had a long run. Now, did you grow up with Gunsmoke, or did you come back to it from a later era?
No, it's well before my time, but with the invention of DVR, and you can just record all those old shows, and my husband and I binge watch at least 3 episodes a day.
Now, it's an old Western. What is it that you and your husband, like, what is it that you love about Gunsmoke?
So, it's kitschy, and it's sometimes silly, but the actors and actresses do a very good job of convincing you that they are Festus or, you know, Matt Dillon, so.
Excellent, Monique. Gunsmoke. Yeah, that's another one. Once you get into it, you got 20 years of watching ahead of you. I guess you can binge it a lot faster than that, though. Todd is with us now in Mount Horeb. You got a couple shows for us, Todd. What do you got?
Actually, I have a couple of awards. I love Green Acres and the Batman with Adam West. Both of them were just ridiculous then, play on words, running gags through the shows. I think both of those are just hilarious. I think they held up pretty well, too.
They were in syndication when I was a kid. I think they were from the 60s originally, but the time they were on TV in reruns was after I got home from school, I think, Todd. That's how I grew up with them and remember pretty fondly. Who's your favorite old Batman TV show villain?
Actually, I like Mr. Freeze.
Oh.
And you hardly see those anymore when they MeTV has them on after monster movies, but you never see Mr. Freeze much. He's my favorite.
All right, Todd, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. Katie joins us now in Milwaukee. Katie, what do you like to watch again?
I will watch Gilmore Girls over and over every season. I just love it so much.
What is it? So this is what I'll admit, I have not watched at all, but I know a lot of people who love the show. What is it you love about the show or the characters that keeps you coming back?
To be honest, I hated it when I first watched it, and then over time I grew to love them. I became addicted. I will rewatch it every fall and every winter. They're just lovable, and some of them you love to hate.
And are there, do you have like a community of friends you talk about Gilmore Girls with, or is this just a Katie solo experience?
I do. My sister-in-law watches it as well as her dogs. It is their soothing thing that they will not bark at, that they put on the TV when they're gone.
Awesome. Dogs love Gilmore Girls. Lesson to pet owners out there. Katie, thanks for the call. We are hearing from you right now about your favorite TV shows to revisit, maybe on streaming, DVD, or reruns. What do you think holds up about it? Or is there a show that everybody was watching back then you didn't watch till later? I did that with Twin Peaks, actually. I missed it when it was on, but I heard somebody overheard somebody talking about a key plot twist there. Who did it? And when I watched it years later, I already knew the answer. It was still a fun watch. You could join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation, hear from you maybe, coming up on Central Time. See the money one more time. Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're taking your calls about older TV shows that you've just gotten into or shows that you rewatch. The theme from Suits there, which prompted this discussion, a lesser known show that's found new life, apparently. Big, big life on Netflix. You could join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page a show that you love to rewatch or an older show that you discovered more recently. 800-642-1234 is the number. Kevin joins us now in Milwaukee. Kevin, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What's your show? Man,
my show is always the original Star Trek.
All right. Now, I had some Next Generation era stuff I was into. What is it about the original Kirk edition of Star Trek?
Oh, the reason I like it because I always like how Bones and Leonard Nimoy playing Spock was always after one another. You know, he has his logic and Bones have his realistic, and they just bicker back and forth all the time, but yet they enjoy one another.
Excellent, Kevin. Thanks a lot. The original Star Trek, just a few seasons of that. I guess some movies, too. Michael is with us now in Milwaukee with, I think, some more science fiction, too. Michael, hi.
Hi, yeah. So my thing as a kid was Stargate SG-1. Obviously, you know, I love the sci-fi. I love the premise and all the cast, especially Richard Dean Anderson. You know, he's a great actor. And then nowadays, though, I actually just enjoy watching Family Guy on reruns on TV.
I want to ask about Stargate, because that was one you said you watched as a kid. Do you go back and watch it? Does it hold up? Because sometimes those things you loved when you're young, it's hit or miss whether you're going to like them.
I think the nostalgia effect is good, and watching it back. Obviously, you know, when you go back and watch older stuff, you're just like, wow, that's really old. And back then, it used to feel so amazing and like new, and like the graphics were great and everything. You know, going back, it doesn't hold up as well, but it's still enjoyable.
Awesome, Michael. Thanks for sharing those with us. Liz joins us in Holman. Liz, hello.
Hi.
What shows did you want to bring up?
Well, there's two, actually. Of course, MASH is kind of like a good old familiar hug every time that comes on. I love to watch it. But I really love watching Battlestar Galactica, another sci-fi. And I mean the newer episodes, not the original series that came out, but the newer ones.
I got to say, Liz, I watched the newer Battlestar Galactica. I liked it. And then in the last season, I watched a few episodes, and then I fizzled out. Should I go back? Should I complete it?
I think you should. Yeah, it was kind of a little bit of a problem where people were like, oh, I don't know if I like the way it ended. And I'm like, it ended just fine. I loved it. And I will be 100% honest. I was so wrapped up in those characters that when it ended, I had family coming over. They were coming in late that night from out of town. And they walked in the door, and there was 10 minutes left of the show, and they started talking to me, and I shushed them really quick, and I said, be quiet.
Excellent. Thanks a lot for sharing that with us, Liz. We are taking your calls and comments with old TV shows you love to watch or shows you like to watch again and again, whether they're old or new, on Facebook. Joe, oh, it says another vote for Gunsmoke there. Jocelyn writes, everybody loves Raymond. That Marie, Jocelyn says, she was so funny. Back to your calls. Mark joins us in Bloomer. Mark, what's your show?
Welcome back, Totter. 100%. Oh. Because I was like Arnold Horshack. I can relate.
I guess Arnold Horshack is probably the closest kid I was to that. Now, this is weird that you say that, Mark, because I was talking to one of my childhood friends the other day, and his wife lately just went nuts for watching Welcome Back, Kotter again. This is a show from the 70s, I'm going to say. I only have distant, vague memories of it. What made you either get into it or pick it back up?
I can totally relate. That was me in high school. I was one of the sweat hogs.
Awesome, Mark. Thanks a lot for the call. Bill joins us now in Lake County, Illinois. Bill, what show are you going back to?
I like Have Gun, Will Travel with Richard Boone.
And was that a Western? That's what I've never seen. Was that a Western?
Oh, yeah. He was the Western version of James Bond, in my opinion.
Oh, that's right. Okay. Yeah, I haven't seen it, but that was kind of the gist I got. This is like a super, almost a superhero of the Old West, kind of.
Yes, exactly right.
All right.
Just another one I like to watch on YouTube is the old Ernie Kovacs show.
Oh, that's going back pretty far. All right, Bill, thanks for the recommendations. We've got Mike joining us now in Sheboygan. Mike, hello.
Hi. Monty Python's Flying Circus. It's the only show that our senior class would get together in the library. And it's the only time some of my senior class members would ever go to the library was the night after Monty Python's Flying Circus, because we just enjoyed it so much and we'd laugh. And the movies are fabulous too. Life of Brian. And it's just, the humor is just, it's timeless.
And Mike, do you go back and watch, you're watching in the library or talking about it in the library in high school. Do you watch episodes now?
I don't have any access to episodes now, but The Life of Brian was one of the, I went to a religious college, and some of the ministers would laugh so hard at that movie because it was just so irreverent of everything. And it's just, it's got such, I mean, at the time, the humor is beautiful.
Well, it's got a great message for Wisconsin, right, Mike? Blessed are the cheesemakers.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Thanks a lot for that call, Mike, at 800-642-1234. Taking your calls on great old shows to watch or old or new shows that you watch again and again, maybe a comfort show. Still time, a line opened up if you had a busy signal earlier at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Paul is with us now in Milwaukee. Paul, hi.
Hey, how are you doing, Rob?
Good. What do you like to watch?
Hey, I tell you, I really love the watching Jack Benny, his TV show, and all the spooky shows that came, like, you know, Alfred Hitchcock and all the things like that that examine cultural issues and explore them through the metaphor, sometimes of horror, sometimes of comedy. And I know that so many of these had their basis in radio. And I remember, you know, and you would see those, they made the transfer into the 50s and 60s into popular culture television. But I think the saddest and spookiest thing is when you guys used to have an old time radio show every Sunday, and my love and I would listen to it. And then it got canceled because people thought it was racist and sexist. But I think it was really called old time radio for a reason. And it was a wonderful basis to have that. I think that should never have been canceled.
Paul, thanks for calling in. Andy joins us now in Milwaukee. Andy, what are you watching?
Oh, I'm watching Moonlighting now that it's on streaming, and I'm really loving it.
Andy, I keep seeing stuff about Moonlighting lately. Now, that's the Bruce Willis, Cybill Shepherd show from, what, the 80s. Did it just come out on streaming? Because I keep seeing people writing about it.
It did. It just came out on Hulu. They had one of these fabled rights issues, I think, with a lot of the music. It took a while to get it on to streaming. And so they're finally there, and I'm just loving it.
And there's that the famous Shakespeare episode. Have you gone back and watched that one yet?
Yes, The Taming of the Shrew. I didn't get to it yet, but that's the one that definitely occupies a lot of my brain right now. I can hardly wait to get to it.
Excellent.
But smartly written, and actually, really, the early episodes seem to be very film noirish, which I don't really remember. A lot of funny, but also a lot of very L.A. grit. So it's great.
Interesting. Andy, thanks a lot for the call. Time for a couple few more callers. Doug is with us in Egg Harbor. Doug, hi.
Yeah, hey, I haven't heard MASH yet, or was I maybe out of the vehicle? When
I think you might have been calling it. Somebody did mention MASH, but you could second MASH for sure. And do you have another one, yeah. Doug?
Yeah, the Andy Griffith Show, and there was always a life lesson in every half hour or so. And a half hour took like 25 minutes to watch it. It wasn't full of commercials.
Excellent, Doug. Thanks for the suggestions. Tracy joins us in Rice Lake. Tracy, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to recommend, Tracy?
The George Byrne and Gracie show and all four of Lucy Arnaz's shows.
Okay. Where do you watch the George Burns and Gracie Allen show these days?
They actually are on Tubi.
Oh, wow. You can find just about everything out there. Thank you for that, Tracy. I didn't know that. Kimberly joins us now in Madison. Kimberly, hi.
Hey there. The Expanse. Thanks to Meghna Chakravarti talking about it on, what was it? On Point.
On Point, yeah. Now, I have watched The Expanse. I've read many of the books. Did you come in with the books first or the TV show?
I did not. No, it was after the interview discussion, and I thought it was so apropos. So I watched it, and I binged the crap out of it. So now I'm sad after watching all six seasons.
Yeah, it ends a little abruptly. I feel like they got canceled halfway through or something and had to come to a quick conclusion. But Kimberly, thanks. Time for one more quick call. Roger is with us in DeForest. Roger, hi.
Yeah, double up on Monty Python's Flying Circus. In college, we used to go to the Memorial Union. There was a whole bunch of people would show up, and we'd listen to it and watch it there. There was also a radio program with the same type of humor. I don't know what it was called. Terry Gilligan and a whole bunch.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay. I thought you were going to maybe say Fire Sign Theater. That was in the same kind of spirit, I think, as Monty Python, but it was a radio show. Roger, thanks a lot. Thanks to everybody who called in. There is still time for you to share that rewatchable TV show. Head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page. Tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, state lawmakers are digging into truancy in Wisconsin schools. A commission will try to find out why kids don't show up at school. Check out the problem and solutions tomorrow morning at 7:30. I can't eat spicy food like I used to could because of, you know, reasons, but I do understand why people like spicy stuff. If you are a fan of extreme heat in your food, there's a new pepper in town made just for you. As reported by NPR, there's a new Guinness record holder for the spiciest pepper in the world. It's called Pepper X. It was bred by the Pucker Butt Pepper Company in South Carolina, can I say that? Which also developed the previous record holder, the Carolina Reaper. Now, I saw a picture, not a lot to look at. Small, wrinkly, and yellow-green, but on that Scoville heat unit scale that measures the spiciness of peppers, it clocks in at 2.693 million. Compare that to a jalapeno, which tops out at maybe 8,000. So would I ever try Pepper X? That is a definite no. Too hot for radio. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Many religions and spiritual groups have rules or traditions when it comes to food. Whether it's certain foods or periods of time one shouldn't eat or specific recipes we could associate with a place of worship, our beliefs can often influence our meals. You might not know some of the religious or spiritual history behind some common foods you find at the grocery store today. In a new book, our next guest digs into the historical connections between American faith and food. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do your beliefs influence what you eat or don't eat? Are there certain foods you associate with your religion or maybe what you eat after a worship session? Did you have a church cookbook or other food tradition involving your place of worship? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Christina Ward is a Milwaukee-based writer and editor who's vice president of the publishing company Feral House. Her latest book is called Holy Food, How Cults, Communes, and Religious Movements Influenced What We Eat and American History. Christina, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to talk about this.
Now, you write in the book that you get asked this a lot, but I'm still going to ask you, what led you down this path? I think it's not a connection a lot of people would immediately leap at, to the connection between faith and food.
Right. I think I put it down to growing up in Milwaukee and then being exposed to a lot of people. Public schools are great. You get to meet folks from different kinds of backgrounds and learn a little bit about what they believe. But it was spending the summers on my grandmother's very rural farm in Jackson County. And it was like the late 70s. And I remember there was an itinerant preacher that came along and was going to take all the kids to a tent revival. And it was kids only. And it makes more sense as an adult that every farm in the area sent their kids. And you got a reward, a little bit of an ice cream sundae if you answered the questions correctly about the Bible. And that, I think, for me, really cemented this idea that food and religion are intertwined and that they can, the food can also serve a purpose for believers.
Part of the story in your book is about food, but a big part of it is also about various new religious movements throughout American history. Now, some of us might think, oh, you know, the 60s, we saw all these new traditions and spiritual awakenings and things like that. I learned from your book, I kind of knew it, but you really spelled it out. This has been a constant in the United States. We're like a laboratory for the creation of new religious and spiritual traditions. Can you talk about that a little before we dig more into the food?
Yeah, absolutely. The United States, it has essentially a trifecta. There's three big elements that help essentially foster an environment where people feel comfortable about exploring different avenues of worship, of religion. And that is our first, of course, the First Amendment. We don't have a state religion. We don't, you know, have a national religion, whereas many countries, especially in Europe, have a national state religion. And that keeps the belief systems fairly intact. The United States does not have that. And our tax laws are very generous to religious organizations, because primarily when those tax laws were put into place, churches were mainly responsible for the social services that were required to keep a community going. And then, of course, the third thing is our own history of being settled by being occupied by kind of religious fundamentalists.
Some of the common themes that come up again and again, a lot of traditions when it comes to their food end up avoiding meat completely or partially. And that's, some come out of European Christian traditions. Some are coming out of or inspired by, say, Hinduism or Buddhism. Why does vegetarianism keep coming up in so many different new religious movements in the United States?
Especially the ones that are rooted in the Christian tradition, they skim and they thoroughly read the Bible. And, you know, and that's, again, the Old Testament of the Bible is something that the Islam, Judaism, and Christianity all follow. And so the idea of the kashrut, the Leviticus, those rules, those laws are culturally embedded in all of the main religious traditions. But the new religious groups started digging further, and they found a passage in Genesis, and that's very early on, that essentially said that God created plants, seeds, and fruits to be the human food, and therefore human diets should be entirely plant-based.
And so that's the Christian tradition, and but it seems like other sources of vegetarianism found fertile ground in new religious movements in America too.
Absolutely. And in a lot of the times in the Hindu tradition, there's a concept called ahimsa, and my apologies for my bad pronunciation. And it's a concept that means do no harm, kill no living thing, plants included. And on that spectrum, you'll get varying degrees of vegetarianism and veganism. And it's why many people following Hinduism don't eat meat at all, because killing a creature, killing a living being to make food for yourself would be against the belief system. And at the extreme, many groups like Jainism, they believe even further that you can only eat plants that are regenerative. So if, for example, an apple is okay because the tree produces it and it falls to the ground. Spinach, because you can clip it and it keeps the plant alive. So anything that doesn't kill the actual plant, whereas like a carrot, you eat a carrot, you pull it out of the ground, that carrot is, you know, essentially dead. So there's always a spectrum in how people interpret the rules and how they apply them.
Talking to Christina Ward, Milwaukee-based writer, about her new book, Holy Food, How Cults, Communes, and Religious Movements Influenced What We Eat and American History. You can join in at 800-642-1234, maybe to share your own story of a connection between food and faith. That's 800-642-1234. Now, Christina, there's a lot of history in the book. There's also a lot of recipes in the book. You're literally looking at all these different faith traditions, big and small. What kind of recipes were you looking for to represent all these diverse religious movements?
I wanted recipes that, one, would taste good if you made them. Of course, you know, there's subjective.
There were some
taste
rejects
issues
out there, I imagine.
There were a lot of rejects. It takes a while for essentially like new vegetarians as a concept to kind of come up to speed when all you know is a very heavy meat-based diet. So these cookbooks and these recipes that the groups published really helped new believers get on the right path for the dietary system. And they also acted as an attractant to new believers. If you picked up an SDA, you know, a Seventh-day Adventist cookbook, you might be more interested in learning about the belief system. And I felt it was important for people to not just read about the food and the groups, but also maybe to try and get a taste of how they ate.
Speaking of Seventh-day Adventists, I'm from Michigan. And there was a little over 100 years ago, a Seventh-day Adventist spa that started with a lot of health treatments, including a lot of enemas and things like that. And it was led by a fellow by the last name of Kellogg. And I eat the descendants of his products all the time. Can you talk about the religious origin of our breakfast cereals shelves at the grocery store?
Yeah, absolutely. And there's, again, it's that convergence of tax laws and, you know, the idea of food and helping the believers and helping people find the right dietary path. And so at the Kellogg Sanitarium, what Kellogg was doing was using Seventh-day Adventist principles about no stimulants of any kind. And the Seventh-day Adventists didn't eat spicy food at all. They felt like even like black pepper was too spicy and would provoke temper. And so it was a time period of a couple things, of really heavy diets in starch. And let's just, I'm going to say it, it made people constipated. And so the sanitarium spent a lot of time, Dr. Kellogg, of trying to help people poop. And so a lot of the diet is about really being a little bit more healthy and getting clean on the inside and clean on the outside, because the body is a temple.
And Little Debbie snack cakes too.
Yeah. The Little Debbie snack cake started, they originally used carob and not chocolate. And when the Seventh-day Adventists sold the company, I think in the early 80s, they use chocolate. But if you grew up earlier than that, you might remember the odd taste of those, because they used carob instead of chocolate, kind of a mix. But the first one was the oatmeal cake. And again, it followed all of the principles that the Seventh-day Adventists recommended for their diet. And if it made it easy. And because the tax laws said that you could, as a church, as a religious organization, create and sell products that followed your mission. And that's why we saw in the United States a lot of these groups become entrepreneurial, both in publishing cookbooks and creating products that you see on the grocery shelves today.
We're talking to Milwaukee-based author Christina Ward about her new book. It's called Holy Food, How Cults, Communes, and Religious Movements Influenced What We Eat and American History. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. Is there a food you associate with your faith or belief system? Something you eat maybe in the church basement after the service or after a wedding? Or is there a food you associate with funerals or memorials? Join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, experiences, or questions for our guest. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Christina Ward, writer and editor from Milwaukee, with us today to talk about her new book, Holy Food, How Cults, Communes, and Religious Movements Influenced What We Eat and American History. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you see connections between food and religious or spiritual beliefs in your life. What questions do you have about the history of food and religion in the U.S.? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Christina, Johnny Appleseed, I've heard the legends. Johnny Appleseed was real and had a very spiritually based mission in planting those seeds. Can you tell that story?
Yes, absolutely. So John Chapman was a follow of what's called a Swedenborgian religion, and after the Swedish scientist. And again, they were vegetarians and extreme in the sense that they really believed some of that idea of do no harm, kill no plants. And so why that's important to Johnny Appleseed is he had perfected a methodology of starting apple trees from seed, whereas so often people starting orchards were doing that by grafting. And Swedenborg and the believers of that and Chapman felt that that was harming the tree, and that was not a good way to start apple farms. And he traveled west throughout the frontier of the country, essentially teaching how to plant apples from seed. Why that's so important is this is the days before water filtration, and finding drinkable water was really critical. And people of that time period didn't always drink straight water. What they were drinking was cider, was drinking what they call small beer, essentially a fermented liquid. And the apples were super critical to creating a cider and creating a liquid that was going to keep people alive.
Now, another theme that pops up in different decades, different faith traditions, Christina, in your book is the idea of opening a restaurant. In some cases, offering free food to bring people into a service. In some cases, as a money-making opportunity, often relying on cheap or free labor of parishioners. Talk about some of the examples where we saw religion turn into restaurant.
It's funny because a few that were started in the 1920s are still operating today. And that's the United House of Prayer for All People that they still offer as part of their service. And primarily they're in the southeast of the United States. There's a great one in D.C. and in New York. And they offer a cafeteria style, which is great kind of Southern style soul food. And that, again, is part of the practice. It becomes a service to the community because it's very low price. And it's an opportunity for the organization, for the group to earn a revenue, to earn some money to keep their organization going. And of course, very few actually go outwardly proselytizing to try to recruit new members, but they always have material available so you can learn more. One of the modern ones too, you might see, is Vegan Hut, Loving Hut Vegan is part of a new religious movement. And so again, they started these restaurants to help generate revenue, do community service, and recruit new members.
A bigger scale example, the Unification Church, run by the late Sun Myung Moon, people derisively call them Moonies sometimes, a huge player in the raw fish for sushi industry.
Yes, they are the providers of almost, I think it's 80% of the sushi fish in the United States. What's most interesting, I think, about the Unification Church's is business is that because it is a bit of a closed group with kind of high standards for their moral behavior of their members who are then also working in the industry, is they've associated with another group to do the transportation. So the Nation of Islam, in a long tradition of training truck drivers and some longshoremen, often work very closely with the Unification Church to help transport that fish. And so that's a really great example of two new religious movements, a little on the extreme side for both, working together to help support each other and their food businesses.
Talking to Christina Ward about her new book, Holy Food, How Cults, Communes, and Religious Movements Influenced What We Eat and American History. Christina, the word cults is in the title there. There's debate over what exactly constitutes a cult. But all that said, there are cases where these things take a darker turn, where food is used in some ways as a way of control, of regulating the lives of members of faith. What were some of the more worrisome stories you ran into?
Absolutely. So, you know, to be clear, a cult is something, a group that has a high control. They're controlling how you think, how you feel, what information can come into your life, as well as some autonomy, bodily control. And that's where the food comes in, about how to control the body. Many of the really high control groups with terrible outcomes often recommended fasting, extreme fasting, or would withhold food as a punishment. I'm thinking, or as a pressure test. Yogi Bhajan, who founded the Happy Holy Healthy Organization and famously wouldn't let people join the group until they did a 3-day garlic fast. And it wasn't so much of a fast as a test. You had to eat garlic for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, one clove, and if for 3 days. And if you could do that, it sent a signal to Bhajan that you were open, you were receptive to following pretty inane directions. And then he knew that that was someone he wanted in his group because they were more controllable.
You also write about foods associated with death and funerals and memorials. Now, there are, I think, foods that people often will bring to that wake or whatever. There were some more closely associated foods that literally you held the food over the deceased, often in a coffin or similar situation. Can you talk about some of those death foods?
And this is a much earlier tradition, so we don't see it much in the 20th century at all. And it's really born out of some of the European folk traditions that then got incorporated into the Christianity. And it's primarily what you see is in the Christian beliefs. And so you hear things in the Dutch have a dudkoeks, which is dead cakes. And they were essentially a cookie that memorialized the person who died that people traditionally would eat afterwards. In Wales, they have proper like death cakes and sin eaters, where essentially you'd make a cake and that would represent all of the sins of the person and then consume it and have a designated person consume it. And they were essentially eating the sins of that person, freeing that person to go to heaven. In Bavaria, there was tradition of, again, of putting a cake on the actual corpse for a bit and then consuming it. And you'll see this, it's almost a form of cannibalism. And that's what anthropologists will tell you. And essentially you're getting that power. You get the power of the person. You're helping absolve them of sins by participating in these rituals of associating the food and death.
I want to check out one of the historical figures you talk about in the book, George Washington Carver. We know him as a scientist, big in developing different forms of agriculture. But you point out something I didn't know. A lot of his work was driven by his faith. What were some of the connections?
Carver, again, I look at him as a genius. In all of my research, I'm convinced that more people need to know about George Washington Carver, and not just the peanut part. Mm-hmm. He was a brilliant scientist in botany and plants. And what he did was inspired. He felt he heard the voice of God, and he explored, as many people did in the earliest 20th century, not one particular spiritual pathway or joining a church, but many, and being open. And so he was at times a Baptist. He was at times following kind of his own spirituality based on what he was reading and the influences around him. And he felt that his work was necessary and driven by God, who told him that the plants would speak to him, and that he really needed to serve his people, and his people being Black people, and trying to teach them to be as self-sufficient as possible. And one of the ways to self-sufficiency, of course, is controlling your own food supply.
And a lot of what he did ends up in food we still eat today. Can you talk about some of the foods, some of them from Africa, I believe, that he helped turn into a part of our agriculture?
Right. So if we think about what is often referred to as the Black Belt, and that is a super soil-rich area in the South, and it's primarily where a lot of enslaved people were kept enslaved. But because that plantation system, it's a monoculture, and it depleted the soils. So in that post-Civil War era, those were soils that weren't great for growing food for the people that were now living there. And so Carver, using plant sources that had long been cultivated by the enslaved people that had come to the United States that they had smuggled from Africa, were great at what's called nitrogen fixing. So he was using cowpeas and using these legumes to not just grow food, but to replenish the soil so it could grow food. And those breakthroughs, we still use those today.
And briefly, Christina, you gathered recipes from over 200 years of faith traditions. Is there one that you've latched onto that's part of your personal food tradition now?
Well, I've got a sweet tooth, so I have to say that right away. So I'm always going to go for the things that are sweeter.
Same.
There's a group from the 1970s, and they were a UFO slash Buddhist slash Hindu slash pretty much everything kind of cult. And it's called the Sunburst Bakery. And they have a recipe for apple corn cookie. And it's naturally gluten-free. They didn't intend it to be. That's just how they made it. And it's delicious. That's one of my go-to favorites. I've been making it without even telling people because it's just such a good cookie.
Christina, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. And I hope people think about their own food and religion.
That's Christina Ward. Her new book is Holy Food, How Cults, Communes, and Religious Movements Influence What We Eat and American History. Christina will be presenting her book at a pair of talks in Milwaukee this weekend, Good Hope Public Library, Saturday at 2, Lion's Tooth Books, Sunday at 2 p.m. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time. Coming up after the news is the American system of government at a breaking point. The authors of a new book say we need to make changes to avoid the risk of authoritarian rule. Check out the argument in Tyranny of the Minority, How American Democracy Reached the Breaking Point. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.